Welcome to the House Hacking Success Podcast, where you'll learn the path to free rent and financial freedom through real estate. Featuring your hosts, Brad LaBrie and Drew Klingler.
Welcome to House Hacking Success. Today we got Brandon on the show. He works in real estate. He works for Gallagher Insurance Company. He knows a lot about real estate. He's a house hacker. He's also an agent, and he just bought his second house hack. We brought him on today. We're going to talk about that second house hack. We're going to talk about the first one too and what the transition was like. And we're also going to talk about just the home buying process in general and try and get like the step-by-step process broken down. How are you doing today, Brandon?
Doing great, Drew. How you been?
Been great, man. Life is good.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back. It's an honor. I know the first one was really awesome. I've probably listened to it 100 times now, but I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Your first episode was great. And it's always cool to like hear the updates about how the first house hack was going and what's happening with the second one. And, you know, so much can happen over a year or two. So it's great to have you back.
Yeah, time flies. I think, you know, when you're looking down, you got goals in mind and things you want to achieve. As long as you're chipping away at day after day, next thing you know, you look up and, you know, the first house hack's done, on to the second one. So time does fly.
Absolutely. So let's break down your first house hack and kind of remind the show what that looked like for you. And then we'll talk about the second one.
Yeah. So that first house hack, so I'm in Michigan. It was in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It was right in the COVID era. So some showings were virtual. It was kind of a tough time, but there was still a lot of interest in the market. I think it took me about 8 different offers on different homes before I finally landed my first house hack. Purchased it. I had to use an appraisal guarantee, which is pretty common now. The appraisal guarantee I had at the time was only $5,000. I think nowadays $5,000 wouldn't get you anywhere. But yeah, it was, you know, I think the biggest thing with that one is I didn't purchase a home that was completely redone. I chose one that still needed quite a bit of work. And I think a lot less individuals were interested in a home like that, which increased my odds and allowed me to win that deal.
Very cool. Sorry, I might've missed. What year was that?
That would have been 2020. Yeah, okay. 2020.
Yeah. And I'm seeing, like you're talking about the guarantee and the appraisal gap. I'm seeing a lot of that now. And, you know, it's crazy what people are offering. Everyone just seems to have cash after selling houses, and then they're coming through and they're guaranteeing 15,000-20,000 on top in case the house doesn't appraise.
Yeah, I think so. When you talk about demand and everyone, you know, speculates, oh, this, you know, we're doomed for a crash or this market is insane. What you have to realize is what you have here is millennials, a very large, you know, generational group of individuals. Millennials are reaching that home buying age, right? Which is, you know, mid-20s to early 30s. There are so many millennials who have good paying jobs. It's pretty common for millennials to have gone to college, graduate, and have a very good paying job, as opposed to, you know, previous eras where maybe college and a, you know, great employment after college wasn't as popular, I'd say. So you have a lot of qualified buyers out there, which is attributing to the housing market we have now. And, you know, I think folks get really caught up with, they're like, oh, look at that. Look, $50,000 over ask. And what you'll see is you have, for one home, you have 30 offers. So what that says, simply in supply and demand, we have one good, and the supply is one, and the demand is 30. So I think that's where, you know, America's really going through a tough time. We just don't have the supply. So there's a lot of folks going after, you know, the same properties, and that's across the country.
Yeah. And that especially applies to single families too. You know, you might think, duplex, triplex, fourplex are gonna be hard to buy because I'm competing with investors, right? Well, investors are going to make sure it's a good deal when they buy. A lot of single family properties, people just want a home and they don't care if it's a good value. They don't care what the appreciation is going to be. They want to buy a house and that's it. And if they have the cash, they're going to pay what they can to get it. So the competition is a lot higher with single family properties.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And what you have a lot of emotional buyers, right? And maybe they've lost in 5 or 6 deals and they've absolutely had it. They don't care what they pay. They just want a home, a place to call their own, you know, with their family, start raising kids. And yeah, they're not investors in most case scenarios. So they're probably not looking at the numbers like an investor would.
Yeah, absolutely. And that can make it hard for the people that want to invest or want a house hack. But, like you said, you had to put in 8 offers to get the house. And, you know, sometimes it takes putting in offers and getting denied over and over and over. But as long as you're continuing to put in offers, I mean, it's going to happen eventually.
Yeah, you have to have a strong mindset. You can't, when you get knocked down, you really have to have a strong mindset to get back up and get back after it. So to circle back full loop, I got in that house hack. I got 2 roommates to move in, friends and buddies from college. And for really the past 2 years, I've just been fixing that home up while living in it, painting room by room, redoing the hardwood floors, doing some work in the bathroom, the kitchen, handful of these different things that really just make the appearance a lot nicer, updating some of the appliances, and really doing it all my own. Over the course of 2 years, bit by bit. And now I would say I probably have one of the nicer homes, you know, on the block at least. And what's been wild to see is, along with home prices increasing, the cost to rent has significantly increased. So what I underwrote this deal at, which was around a break even deal, you know, per bedroom when I had bought it, now is significantly over that. Because the rent is so much higher now.
Did you end up raising rents on your tenants, or did you keep it the same?
Yeah, well, I had the 2 gentlemen in here for those 2 years, and I kept it the same. I certainly could have bumped, but now I'm moving out into my second house hack, and those numbers that worked out to be about a break even, which is about $1,000, my mortgage, taxes, insurance, all the bills. About $1,000. I was bringing in about $1,000, living for free, breaking even. Now moving out and renting this one out full time, I'm able to rent it for about $2,000. So I'm cash flowing after bills are paid about $1,000.
That's awesome. That's really good.
Which is significantly higher than I originally underwrote for.
Are you doing still rent by the room as you move out, or are you renting out the entire property?
Yeah, so running out the entire property, but really, I have 3 tenants that are paying me individually. So it's not like I'm running out to like a family and there's just 1 check. Really, I have 3 individuals. And here in Grand Rapids, it's a very popular area for young professionals or folks that are, there's a handful of colleges nearby. In my case scenario, the tenants that I selected, after thorough background checks, the tenants I selected are 3 nurses. They have strong employment. They have great rental history. And I know that they'll take care of this place.
So how does the lease work in that situation? Are you doing individual leases or are you doing a master lease?
Good question. So I have them all on 1 lease. They do pay me individually, but the reason I have them all on 1 lease, there's a clause in there that is called joint and several, meaning they're all individually liable for the full amount. So if one individual isn't paying, I can hold another individual liable for the full amount. So it kind of motivates everyone to make their payments.
In this situation, do the tenants know each other personally, or did they apply individually?
Yeah, so I had probably over 30 applicants, and there may have been scenarios where individuals didn't know one another. What I found to be the most qualified individuals that I selected, they do know one another, which I think can help avoid some conflict and overall make it a more smooth process.
And then I know that when you were house hacking this property, you had some buddies of yours that were renting rooms. Now, what's your plan with that situation? Are they going to move to the second house with you?
Yeah, that's exactly it. One individual is actually going to be moving, so I'm replacing with him with another friend. But one of the folks that's here now is going to be moving to the new property. And again, I always try in a house hack scenario to try and live with a friend or someone that I know is going to be a great option to live with, rather than go out and seek, I don't want to say someone off the street, but someone that I don't know, haven't lived with. Because, you know, living with someone you know, their cleanliness, you know, what they do in their free time, that can be a real gamble, especially in your own home.
Yep.
So choosing to live with individuals you know and have vetted out and qualified, it's my best recommendation.
It's really good advice because it's so different when you're doing a single family versus a multifamily, right? You're sharing the kitchen and the bathroom and the living room area and stuff like that. And, you know, if their idea of clean is different than your idea of clean, there's probably going to be some internal conflict from, you know, at least one person that can probably cause some kind of issues within the house. You know, whereas like a multifamily, they're in a different unit. We got walls separating us.
Right.
You know, you can keep it professional. You don't have to know them. You don't really have to care how clean it is as long as they're not destroying the property. If they're not doing their dishes, who cares? But do you have any advice for how to get along with your tenants when you're house hacking a single family?
Absolutely. So it's a great point that you make. And what I'll tell you is, I think maybe most of us have had scenarios where we've had tough roommates, right, back in college. And, you know, what you most commonly see is things get maybe petty, right? When you don't do your dishes, someone's going to pile them up and put them, you know, right where you can see them type thing. And I would tell you, my advice is to, I don't say lower your standards, but just understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. And at the end of the day, you're likely living for free or you're cash flowing a little bit of money. And are you going to jeopardize the smoothness of that because of a couple of dishes? You know, if it's something more significant, right? Someone smoking in the house or something that's a real issue, you absolutely need to address that. But if they're minor things, there's shoes by the door or something minor, you really got to take a deep breath. And I would suggest you just let those things go.
Awesome. And then even though you know these guys, did you decide to put them on a lease?
Yeah, I did do a lease. And what I mentioned, I think, on the previous episode is, you know, you really have a lot to lose if you don't treat this as a business. At the end of the day, you saved up all that money, made the down payment, and you're paying for the upkeep of the property. And there's a lot to lose if you don't have a lease in place. And a lease document is really the worst case scenario. You'd like to never have to go to it. But if a circumstance arises where you do need to go to it, you're going to wish you had one.
Yeah, it's great advice. And I definitely recommend, even if you know the person personally, if they're a tenant and they're paying you rent, get them on a lease. And you can kind of use the lease as the bad guy too, right? You know, they signed absolutely. It, you signed it, you both agreed on the terms. You should have gone over the terms with them before they signed it. I like to do that with my tenants and I believe it's required, but it's a great way for you to be like, hey, it's not me, you know, it's in the lease. You got to follow it, right? Like, so
you have to, you have to set standards. And what I tell you and what I did with these three girls that are going to be moving into my original house hack property when I move out, once we signed and executed the lease, we set up a Zoom call or a FaceTime and we just got the chance to know one another. And then I walked us through the lease just to set expectations. And there's nothing crazy on there. But I want to make sure I physically told you we can't have dogs in the house. And here's why, you know, and there's a few things. One thing I pointed out is, you know, when is it appropriate to pick up the phone and either call me or any other maintenance staff we have? And one of the biggest things I point out is water. I don't care if it's 3 a.m. If there is water dripping somewhere where it should not be, call me because water is a huge issue, right?
Yeah.
Just setting the expectations, making sure that they know that, look, it technically via the lease, you can cancel your lease at any time and move out. But the penalty is 2.5 times rent. It's spelled out right here. I would hate to see that. It would be very unfortunate because then I'd be scrambling for a new tenant. But that's in there and you're going to have to pay your way out of it. So absolutely. Just get things off to the right foot. Make sure everyone's on the same understanding.
That's a good clause. I don't think I have that in my lease. I think I have a subleasing clause.
Brendan Bennett gave it to me.
I'm going to add that. That's awesome. Yeah. Because I actually had, I had a tenant who wanted to get out of the lease at one point. And I was like, well, you know what? If I can find another tenant and I can show, you know, the property, maybe we can work this out and I'll get someone in as fast as I can and get you out. And they, you know, they worked with me, but that would have been, you know, that would have been way more convenient.
Brendan actually had a horror story and I'm sure he wouldn't mind me sharing it, but it was essentially a tenant of his that said, hey, I'm moving out next week. See ya. And he's like, no, you're not, because you're here till July or whatnot. And she said, sue me. And it's like, for him, the legal cost to go through all that, it's just like, okay, I guess she got me. So that clause was added to where he's like, okay, that's fine. Just make sure you note right here. And then you have legal grounds to pursue that individual for that sum of money.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, security deposit could be used towards some of that as well.
Yeah.
I think that'd be the case if they just moved out and stopped paying early anyways, but that's always an option. But yeah, that's a cool clause. Now you got the second house hack. Before we dive into that, I'm curious, how did you finance the first house hack?
So the first, it was conventional. I was able to get just a 5% down mortgage on that first one.
When you did the second one, did you do the same type of financing?
So I did, because really you have the option, right? Whether you're doing a 3% FHA or a 5%. And with how much demand is in the market now, FHA can be really tough to stand out as an offer compared to a conventional. Reason being, the FHA loan is a government program, and it allows you to purchase a home for a lesser amount down, just 3.5%. But with that, because it's a government program, there's some stipulations, and the inspections are typically very strict. So when you have someone selling a home and they have 30 offers, and the conventional 5% doesn't have that strict of an inspection, and the FHA has a very strict inspection, they know that this process, if they go with you, the FHA, they know if they choose that, this whole deal could crumble because they found mold in the basement, or, you know, there's paint chips somewhere. So I decided to stay conventional. The biggest thing that you need to understand is your debt to income ratio, which is what lenders are going to use. They're going to look at how much money do you make per month, and how much debt service do you have per month? And that's all your debts. Do you own another property where you're paying a mortgage every month? Do you have a car payment? Do you have student loans? And with me, with the amount of money that I was making when I got my first loan, no problem. When I went to try and ask the bank for another $200,000, $250,000, they said, look, you don't make enough because you already have that other house payment. You have some student loans. You need to make more money for us to feel more comfortable giving you a second loan. So I had to wait about a year. Although I had the cash to put down on a second house, the bank wasn't comfortable giving me that second mortgage. So it wasn't until about a year and a half later, 2 years later, where I made substantially more income, the bank was willing to offer me another $250,000 in lending.
Were you able to use your projected rent that you would be have, like the projected rent that would be coming in from the house that you live in and the one that you're moving into? Were you able to use that?
Yeah. So the answer is no. I didn't need to. But I know that that's a savvy thing lenders can do to the projected rent, that when I move out, there's going to be some income coming from this previous home, and we're going to count that towards my debt to income. That's a very savvy thing that I know some lenders can do. I didn't do it in this case scenario.
Okay. Okay. You never know. I mean, it's so different, and you hear so many stories about what lenders can and can't do. And even in my case, buying my second home, I was going to try FHA, and he was like, we can't do FHA with you because you're keeping the other property. So, you know, some things you hear and then you think they're concrete, and then you try and go get the loan, and then you find out he can't do it. And maybe it's a lender to lender thing, but I don't think that was that kind of situation. So, you know, when you're picking your loans, just make sure you're hashing out with your lender and let them know what your goals are and what exactly you're trying to achieve so they can work.
No, that's a great point. Cause now it sounds like you're going to have to pivot. You likely can't do another FHA. And I think the important thing there is whether it's your lending or it's a decision with your agent or the area you're buying, or the price you're buying, the type of home you're buying, some things can stop you in your tracks, but you just have to take a deep breath, find the best solution, seek advice from individuals who are knowledgeable in this area, find the next best option, take a sidestep, move forward. I don't let it kill you in the tracks. I think a lot of folks are like, I was going to do this, can't do this. Now I'm not going to do anything. Just go get advice, take a deep breath, keep moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you waited a year or two, you know, you worked hard to get your income up so you can get the second one. And, you know, that's sometimes what you have to do. So talk to me a little bit. We had a conversation before we started recording, and we were talking about, you know, move-in ready properties versus, you know, properties that need a little bit of sweat equity and the value of both sides. So tell me a little bit about what the situation is with the second house hack.
Do you increase your odds of purchasing a home when everyone else is going, you know, fanatic of multiple offers on one home? To increase your odds, like I said previously, like I did with this first home, maybe find a home that doesn't have everything that's been redone, something that needs some love and attention. And I think what you'll find is you look at the home that is completely redone and it has 40 offers. You look at the home that has not been redone and needs some work, it might have 5 or 6 offers. So if you want to increase your likelihood of getting a home, I would say look at something that needs work. There's a lot more profitability, I would say. If you purchase at the right price, there's more profitability in the sweat equity side. I'm going to fix this place up, increase the value. For me, anyhow, I did that on this first home and put for 2 years, I fixed this entire place up. And my full-time job in real estate has been getting wild lately. And it's a great income source for me. And I do love what I'm doing there. And I want to continue that. What I don't want to continue is coming home from work after a long day and painting the bathroom, things like that, changing the light fixtures. Yeah. So what I did this second option on my second home is I looked for a house that didn't need much work. And I found just that, a house that was recently completely redone. And if you look at the numbers are going to be, the mortgage is going to be about $1,600 a month. And what I'm going to be charging for rent, again, to close friends of mine, what I'm going to be charging for rent is about $600 a room. I'm going to rent out 2 rooms. So really, I'm only getting $1,200 and my bills are $1,600. I'm going to have to cough up about $400. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm willing to do that is because my first property is now cash flowing $1,000 a month. So because of the sweat equity of the first one and where I was able to get that property to, and my mortgage amount is low on that one because I bought something that needed work, the profitability is there and I'm able to still pay the bills on both places just fine.
Hey everybody, just a quick break from the podcast. I wanted to let you know about the Discord server I started called House Hackers. It's a community that we're building for house hackers and people like you to come hang out. So whether you are looking to get your first house hack, you've already been house hacking, or you're an experienced real estate investor, this is a great place to hang out with like-minded people like you. All you got to do to join is go to the link in the podcast description, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Yeah. And that's a great point too, because we talk a lot about, you know, how house hacking can get you to live rent free. Right. And that's what really gets people interested initially, but you don't necessarily have to live rent free. I mean, what's rent in Grand Rapids right now? I mean, it's getting up there. I know it's higher in more of the dense areas, but it's definitely not $400. You know,
no,
it's a lot more than $400. So, you know, if you can find a living situation where you only have to pay $400 to live there, but you own the property, you get to keep it as a cash flowing rental when you move out, you get the appreciation, the debt pay down, you know, all that great stuff that comes with real estate. Cutting your living expenses down to $400 only is a pretty good house hack.
Yeah. In reality, to your point, cutting it down to $400, but in reality, I'm up a grand from the house before.
Right, exactly.
So I'm still technically living for free. But exactly. What's awesome here is what you have now is you have two assets, two homes that are climbing in value. And what I think is important here too is to compare. I like to compare real estate to stock market investing. And I love the stock market and I'm a fan of it. I'm a fan of long-term buy and hold in stock as well, index funds particularly. I don't have individual stocks. But what I want to compare is how different the two are. A stock and real estate can be similar in the fact that they both have appreciation. So if I bought a great mutual fund 20 years ago, it's likely that that stock fund has trickled its way up over the past 20 years. But here's where real estate's different. Real estate also has cash flow. So while that asset is climbing in value, it's paying you a monthly paycheck. Second thing it has, which is fantastic from a rental aspect I'm speaking, is it has debt pay down. You have someone else who's paying rent and paying your mortgage off every month. So if you have in my case with this new home, roughly a $300,000 home, I put the down payment on and I'll pay for some fixing up over the years, but someone else is paying that $300,000 loan off. As long as I hold it long enough, those tenants will have paid off that mm-hmm. whole loan. They will provide a little bit of cash flow for me every month. And the $300,000 home in 30 years is probably worth $500,000. Yeah. Much different than stock. So I think you had just touched on a few of those, and I want to dive a little bit deeper on that. So
that's a good point too. What was your down payment for your first property?
It was five. Yeah, it was 5%. So I think it ended up being about 14 grand, maybe.
It'd be a lot harder to turn that into $500,000 in the stock market than it would to just buy the property, let the tenants pay it down, plus the $500,000, plus the cash flow, right?
It's another great point. Real estate is the only area where you can buy something worth $300,000 with bank leverage. You can buy something worth $300,000 for, in this recent case of the second house, for about $25,000. So for the stock market, with $25,000, how much stock can you get? $25,000 worth, not $300,000 worth, yep. Right? So that's, again, two differences. And I'm pulling most of this from familiar with Rich Dad, Poor Dad. They have a real estate spinoff book, and they really touch on the similarities and differences of these two. And that's where I'm pulling a lot of this from. It's just really, really great information.
Well, I just learned that. I didn't know they had a real estate spinoff, so I'm going to have to take a look at that.
It's a great book.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's crazy, right? Like, you know, if someone came up to you and like, yeah, you give me 15 grand in 30 years, I'll give you, you know, 500,000 plus $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
You'd be like, yeah, sure. Here you go. You know,
the thing I always think of is, you know, like the best example is, you know, your parents, right? I think a lot of individuals, maybe your childhood home is where your parents are still at. And maybe they've owned it for 20 some years. And it's, you know, they bought it back in the day for $100,000. And now it's worth $300,000. But the only problem is that's the only house they have. You know, when I'm looking at those numbers, you bought it for 100 and it's worth three. I'm like, man, it'd be nice if we had a dozen of these. Right?
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if you don't have the cash, you can do, there's 0% down payment. There's down payment assistance. You know, there's the NAC loan, USDA. You can do 3% with conventional FHA. So I can keep it down. And then just looking, every state has their own down payment assistance programs that can help you out to get for that first property. And then once you get that first property, you're going to start building equity. You can actually use that equity to go and get the next one if you want. You know, it's more debt, it's more leverage. But, you know, the other thing is if you don't want a house hack and you're already in a home, you're probably building up equity. And it is an option to pull out that equity and start to leverage it to buy another property if you choose.
Yeah. So let's touch on that for a minute. So again, the first one I bought for $180,000 is worth, I would say, a good $280,000 now, right? So it's increased $100,000. So to your point, you can tap into that equity, whether it's a home equity line of credit or whether I refinance out. Technically, I can get a new loan and get the bank to give me about $100,000 and still keep that property. And to your point, I can deploy that $100,000 to purchase more homes. But to your point, you know, you got to watch how much you leverage. I don't want to refinance or do a HELOC quite yet. I like how low my payment is now. I like that my cost basis, if you will, is only at 180 grand. So I'm pretty conservative in that aspect. So I'll be leaving that for now.
It's kind of a game, right? Because, you know, if you do pull out that equity, it's going to decrease your cash flow because there's going to be payments on that equity that you pull out, whether it's an increase in mortgage payment or it's a home equity line of credit payment in general. It's kind of a game. Like, are you playing the cash flow game or the appreciation game? Or are you trying to find a balance? If you're playing the appreciation and net worth type of game and you're not too worried about cash flow, I mean, it might be a great option, especially if you have a good job and you're not too worried.
It all comes down to your comfort level, and it comes down to your business model. What are you looking to get out of this? You know, if I was looking to quit my day job and live off cash flow, then minimizing cash flow might not be the best move, right? So it all comes down, again, to your appetite and what you're looking to do as far as a business model. I'll say that I think the day-to-day of, you know, we talked about me putting leases in places and looking through applications, but I know folks who save up their money, purchase a very nice home, hire a property manager, have them handle it all. And then the property manager handles all the tenants, everything. And you get paid a check, you know, every so often, and you got to pay the firm. Sure. You got to pay the property management firm. But then what these folks do is they save up for the next year and they buy another one. And then the one they bought 2 years ago is now worth double. And they just, but again, they're only handling that front end, that purchasing. The rest of it, they're just serving it off to a property manager, which might be very attractive for a lot of individuals.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that. I just had a comment on our YouTube channel that was like, yeah, I heard you say rent out the extra rooms and, you know, you have to talk to people. And me as an introvert, I'm just like, oh, I don't want to do that. And my reply to the comment was like, just hire a property manager. You never have to see your tenants or talk to them.
Yeah. I mean, folks naturally with anything, but real estate in particular, because it's not easy, they're going to find a reason to tell you why it's not a good fit for them, which that's fine. Leave it more for us, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And maybe real estate's not for everyone, but I think there's a way that everyone can make real estate for them. You know, there's not a defined way that you have to follow to be a real estate investor. You can tailor it to your life and your career. You don't want to do a lot of work, buy the move-in ready properties. You don't want to meet people and see them face-to-face and deal with tenants, hire a property manager. If you don't mind tenants, that's great. But there's so many ways around the things that make you uncomfortable. Some of them are just worth being uncomfortable for a short period of time.
And that's it, right? So, I mean, for going on 3 years now, I've lived with several roommates, right? I mean, we've all used the same, you know, washer and dryer in the kitchen and the refrigerator. And there's just a bunch of, you know, food in the same fridge. We're trying to cram things in. That's inconvenient, right? But I'm willing to go through that inconvenience for a few years to really set some awesome things up for the years to come.
That's a great way to go. You know, the other thing we wanted to talk about in this podcast was the home buying process. What would you say the first step is in the process?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I have my real estate license and I have had my real estate sales license since college. Used it working with an investor throughout college. And now I've gotten to the point with these past few years, most of my friends are in that home buying range. And I've been able to utilize that license, not only for my own deals, because I've acted as an agent on these house hacks that I've done, which allow me to bring a little bit of commission back to me, as well as give me what was really nice about the, I always go off tangent, but I'll come back, I promise. What was really nice about this second house hack is the reason I was able to get this deal under contract as quickly as I was able to is because I have my license, because it listed at 8 a.m. one morning. I saw it. I scheduled the time because I'm a licensed realtor. I went and saw it the next 15 minutes, got that agent on the phone and confirmed for him I would give the exact offer that they needed, and they pulled it off the market. I didn't even have to compete with anyone. If you don't have your license, which is probably most individuals, that timeline's tough because you probably can't go see it till after work and maybe it's even the next day. And by then 20 people have already seen it and now we're fighting. That's where I've been able to use it for myself. But to come back full circle on really what that first process is with looking for a home, I would say it's just the first step is just to get your financial house in order, which is what Dave Ramsey would say, but really to have a really good grasp on your finances, your savings, and understand the area you want to purchase in and what homes are trading for in that area. I mean, you're likely, I would say most individuals are going to use a 5% down conventional loan. I would tell you, even if you have more cash, if you could put more down, I would tell you not to, just because 5% is really, 5% is one, all you need. And two, you're borrowing money at only 5% interest rate. If it was much higher, maybe you'd want to put a higher down payment to make your monthly a little bit shorter or smaller. But as folks tend to think that 5% interest rates now are just sky high. The thing is, though, they're comparing it to 2.5%, which was, you know, the past year or so. 2.5% was an all-time record low. If you look at the 1980s, interest rates were about 18%. 1990s, about 10%. And now they're at 5%. So I think it's still a great deal. But really, again, getting your finding what that home's to sell for in that area, take 5% of it, and then you're going to need an extra couple thousand dollars for closing costs. Get that number in mind. Know what that number is. I think in Michigan, really, it tends to average out around, if you're buying a normal home in the $200,000-$300,000 range, it's going to be around $25,000. That's what I would think, you know, would be a safe amount to have saved up. But once you have that organized, I mean, really the next step is going to be to get pre-approved, which is getting with a lender and letting them look through. Again, we talked about that debt to income ratio. How do my finances look? And although I have 25, here's the thing, you might have $25,000 saved up, but your debt to income ratio could be so off that a bank still will not loan you money for a mortgage. So I know you've been through the pre-approval process several times. I'm not sure if you have any advice there.
A lot of paperwork. I can tell you that much, but really just talk to your lender. That's going to be the thing. You can try and figure out what you can afford, and you're going to have to take ownership over what you can afford. Now, whether you're looking at just a house to live in or a house hack, if you're looking at a house hack, I would still even recommend not buying something over what you can afford. Because if you don't have tenants, then you really don't have much of a risk when you're living in the property. But in general, you know, just be a good steward of your finances. Understand that you really don't want to stretch yourself to the level. You don't want to stretch yourself to a paycheck to paycheck kind of lifestyle just because you're buying a house. Make sure you have your finances in order. And you talked about that already, but your lender, you know, they're going to know your debt to income ratio after you do all the paperwork, and they're going to be able to tell you what you can buy at your maximum. And if that's going to be, you know, something that really stretches you, you know, it might be exciting. Oh, cool. I could buy this $450,000 house and, you know, have all this space. But if it's going to stretch you too much financially, you know, maybe bring that bar down a little bit lower.
And really the two key partners you're going to have in this process is your lender and your realtor. And I would tell you, don't just go to the first individual that either comes to mind or offers you these services. You really got to vet it out. And especially, I mean, the lender is going to be important, but I would say, especially with the realtor, I would encourage you to talk to many individuals that, you know, have recently purchased a property and try and find someone that they've used that they have a great review. Someone who has a great experience, who's done this a lot, who knows your area well. I think it's a great move for you to interview several individuals, not just jump with the first individual you talk to.
Yeah. And I'm going to take it another level too. And if you're looking for an investor, or if you are an investor, you should probably be looking for an agent who is also an investor, because they look at houses through a different lens than agents who are buying, you know, or helping people buy houses just to live in. It's just a different perspective. It's not that they're better or worse, but they understand how to run the numbers. They're going to look at a property and be able to tell you if it's a good deal, and they're masters of the area. They understand the market and they're going to understand the local market way better than you're going to be able to understand, because they're living in it daily. They're seeing it constantly. And I'm just going to plug this in here real quick on our website at househackingsuccess.com. If you go there, we do have a form that you can fill out if you're looking for an investor-friendly real estate agent, and we will connect you with one. We've been building up a really big list, so I'll be able to refer you to an agent who actually has investment properties.
That's great. That's a great resource. I think I've just seen horror stories where individuals will run with the first individual that they've met or, you know, just called up a local shop. And again, you hear the adage all the time that rock stars know rock stars. If you know someone in this space who has just consistently shown that they know what they're doing, whether they're an agent or not, they can put you in touch with someone who's pretty darn good.
Yeah. And, you know, you have the option to pick your lender, or you can get referred by your agent. Do you have a personal preference on that?
That's a great question. So we have a lender we work with on my real estate team that if our clients don't have a lender, I significantly push this individual because we use him because he's really good. He's been doing it for 30 years and it's been a great experience. And I've had other individuals who say, no, I have this person or relationship, or it's where my bank is. And I've seen some nightmare scenarios where the deal will fall through because that lender didn't properly dot their I's and cross their T's. I just know the individual that we use, we recommend him because we always have great outcomes.
Because you know him, are you able to get things moving faster?
So that's a great question. And here's the thing. I tend to use people I know that we have chosen because they're as good as they are. But here's what you have there. And this isn't all business. When you know someone real well and you have a business relationship opposed to someone you haven't done business with before, you have the ability to call in favors, I'll call it, right? That individual is probably going to work, I don't say a little bit harder, but because you have that relationship and you continually work with one another, it's really just going to pay off. And like I said, they're able to, in the, you know how it is with different like inspections and different issues that arise. If they have that relationship with you, they're going to do whatever they can to make that deal work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can work both ways too. I mean, there's definitely going to be advantages of being referred by the agent. Me personally, I have a lender that I work with that I wasn't referred to by an agent. Was referred to by a friend of mine, but I continue to work with him because he's just an absolute rock star. Like, he's a beast. He gets things done fast.
Speed is everything. Speed, yeah. And accuracy.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I like him. I like him a lot. I'll keep him around. So, you know, it works either way.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think another thing I wanted to touch on is a lot of folks, and you've heard it for a while now. I mean, I would say folks have probably been hearing it for, I don't know, 10 years now, is that I'm going to wait to buy until the market crashes. A lot of folks are waiting for that market to crash. And I think where they're getting that from is from 2008, right? Because we had this massive recession and the value of homes fell along with the economy. If you look historically on home values along with recessions, there's only been about two or three times where in a recession, the value of homes have fell. Now, certainly the buying and selling may flatten off a bit during a recession. A lot of times the stock market is what's mostly impacted, as well as employment, inflation, these types of things. These typically have issues during a recession. But if you look again historically, just because we're in a recession doesn't mean the value of homes fall. And again, folks have some short-term memory or maybe just don't know all the facts. And they think back to 2008 and they think recession, home values drop. And again, with what we have now with the current market, it's a supply and demand issue. So I do believe we're headed into a recession. I think technically with how is it? Have you seen where now two consecutive quarters, is the GDP has decreased. So now we're technically considered in a recession. I think we're headed that way, but do I think that the home prices are going to start falling? No, because you have 30 individuals that all want one home. So what'll happen if we hit a recession? Well, maybe that number will go from 30 down to 15 or 10. But at the end of the day, these are 30 qualified buyers, and the interest rates rising may price out a few individuals. So again, that 30 number is definitely going to drop, but it doesn't fall completely to where now no one can sell a home anymore. We have a supply and demand issue, and there is far too few homes for how many individuals want homes.
Yeah. You know, maybe the value increase slows down or
exactly
plateaus, but a crash, you know, that takes a lot. Right. And the other thing too, is like when you start trying to time the market, it kind of turns into gambling, and we're investors, not gamblers. And if we're ready to buy and we feel comfortable buying, why not buy? Instead of trying to wait, see if the market goes down, you know, what happens if home values go up while you're waiting and then you lose some money? So, you know, we're not like day trading stocks or anything. We're buying houses when we can, and we're putting tenants in there. And then if there is a crash and we have tenants in there, you know, they are still responsible for paying rent. So it doesn't necessarily matter the value of your home in the short term if there is a crash, as long as you're able to still collect rent. You know, we've talked to a lot of people that survived the 2008 crash, and they had tenants that were paying rent. They had great tenants because they had a great screening process and there was no problem. They were able to make their mortgage payments. You know, we came out of the dip and they just kept going.
Yeah. I'm sure you hear this question. Folks ask it all the time. What do you think the housing market's going to do in the next year or 2 years? I mean, the answer is that real estate investing is a long-term game. And I can't tell you what it'll do in a year. I can't tell you it'll do in 2 years, but I have a pretty good idea in 5 years. And I have a really good idea in 10 years, it's going to go up, because look at the past 100 years of appreciation and the average home price. The average home price in America has increased, I think this past year was over 20% increase year over year, which is the highest it's ever done. I believe the average median home price in America is now like around $350,000. That's remarkable compared to where it was years ago. But the idea there again is that folks get really caught up. Oh, what's it going to do in a year or 2 years? And there's going to be a crash or whatnot. If you're going to be buying and holding for long term, or if you have the ability to buy a home for long term, that's where you'll see, a safety net. The likelihood that that property over long term is going to increase is substantial.
Yeah. And, you know, there's other strategies inside of real estate that aren't necessarily buying rentals. And the timing of the market might be a little bit more important. You know, you don't want to be flipping a house and then the market crashes and then you can't sell that house for a profit and you're out $50,000. But, you know, in general, I'm personally not a house flipper. Brad, you know, he wasn't able to make the show today, but he flips a lot of houses and, you know, he's doing seven or eight at a time. He's not worried. He's still going.
Yeah. I'll tell you that I think every deal is unique in itself, and many deals, it makes sense potentially for a flip. But I know that I've talked to some flip investors who I respect significantly, who have recently said that all through the 2000s up until just recently, they've always had a flipping business. And they said that my biggest regret is not holding them, because properties that I have purchased and flipped in the $200,000 range in Florida or some other really key markets are now worth $600,000. And it's again in place too, because what you kind of miss there, you miss a bit there on the flipping side of things. You miss that appreciation play, that long-term appreciation.
So looping back to the home buying process, we talked about locking up a real estate agent, locking up a lender, getting pre-approved for a loan and working with your lender, making sure that you're telling him your strategy, not just short-term, but talk about your long-term strategy if you plan on buying more properties and give them that visibility. Because chances are, if you like them, you'll probably be working with them in the future too, and they'll be able to help you through that. But after you do those three things, what happens next?
Yeah, so once you get into the process of making offers, so on my first house hack, it was the eighth offer I had made on homes that was accepted. And ironically enough, the second one was also the eighth. It takes a lot. There's a lot of rejection involved, and that may level off here, in the coming months or coming years, as again, interest rates rise and maybe some folks fall in some hard times if a recession does hit. You really have to have a strong mental approach, because the likelihood that you're going to lose on an offer is pretty significant. I mean, folks that I've worked with as an agent, I've done very few deals where the first offer we write is accepted and they're moving into a home. Most of the time, it's fifth or sixth offer we write or so. And I think you have to take certain things into consideration of, don't be stuck in your ways. Talk to your agent and say, hey, out of all the deals you do, all the offers you write, what works? What's successful? What stands out, right? And in today's market, what I'm seeing, appraisal guarantees are very large, which is what you have with an appraisal guarantee is many individuals offering on a home, which rises, it's a bidding war, and it rises that initial offer price. And an appraisal guarantee says, hey, we know that the price has gotten so high that if your bank doesn't appraise it at the value we agreed at, then I will come out of pocket and pay that difference X amount of cash, either a stated amount, I can pay the full amount. So in the most recent house hack scenario that I locked up this deal, the appraisal guarantee was the reason I got it. He said, look, we just redid this home and we just don't feel comfortable. We think it's going to, you know, it's going to sell for around $300,000, but we don't think a bank is going to appraise it at that. So the most important thing to us is an appraisal guarantee. And I said, how big do you need one? I mean, well, what's a comfortable appraisal guarantee? And for them, it was $15,000. So fortunately, my finances were in an order enough to make an offer that large with an appraisal guarantee. But ultimately, that's what won me that deal. So again, talking to your agent on what strategies are working, appraisal guarantee is huge. I'll tell you another big one, but I wouldn't recommend it. Another big one you're seeing is waiving inspection. I think it's wild. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't recommend my clients do it. But the reason that's advantageous to someone selling is if an inspection's waived, then they're not nitpicking anything in the house. They're not saying, hey, we found this leaky pipe and you know you should bring your price down a little bit because of it. Or, hey, we found this issue here and it's going to cost a little bit from the both of us or from you to help remediate that issue before we close. That's another big one too. I'm not sure if you have any other tidbits you've seen thrown in recently.
No, I mean, just to add on to the appraisal guarantees, like, you know, what's going to happen is, say you're offering $250 with a $15,000 appraisal guarantee. What you're saying is if that property appraises for less than $250, you will cover up to $15,000 of the difference, and you're not necessarily paying that money.
Not guaranteed.
There's a chance. There's a chance you get to keep that money. It does make things more challenging for people currently. I think a lot of this is coming from people selling homes, then turning around, buying another one. They got a bunch of cash. So I know for house hackers, first-time home buyers, it is a challenge.
It's separate from your down payment money, right? You have your down payment money that goes to the bank, and then there's this extra allotted amount of money in cash mm-hmm. that you're saying, hey, I will also bring this. And for folks to have your down payment money, say $25,000 plus another $10,000, $15,000, it's a lot of dough to have on the side. But to your point, it's not guaranteed that you use it. If the home does appraise at your example, $250, we can hold on to that $15,000.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It does make things more challenging. And, you know, I think there's going to be cycles and it's going to change. So if you're in a situation where you're getting beat out by these appraisal guarantees and you don't have a guarantee, just keep going. Just keep going. Eventually, you're going to find the right house. Something's going to work and you're going to get an offer accepted. But, you know, you just got to have grit and keep going and keep saving up as much money during the process as you can.
Yeah, I'd say the most likely way you won't get a deal is if you quit. So if you really want one, you just got to keep after it. Keep writing offers and don't keep running into the same wall, right? If your max lending ability is, say, $300,000 and you keep looking at homes that are listed at $300,000 or $305,000, the likelihood that you're going to have an accepted offer there is not likely. So I would tell you, learn from your mistakes. Don't keep doing the same thing. I see a lot of folks wanting to keep writing the same type of offer that is unsuccessful. So I would seek feedback when you lose a deal, find out what you could have done better and pivot. And when you write your next offer, have it improved, have some better terms and conditions and offerings.
When they start looking for a house now, is there anything that you would recommend that they look for specifically in the house as far as how the numbers are, condition of the house?
Yeah, in terms of house hacking, again, with interest rates at about 5%, I still think that's a very affordable lending of money. But if we're looking at it, running the numbers from a house hacking perspective, again, just getting a really good understanding on what a like kind and quality home rents for on a per bedroom basis. And if you're going to be living in one of those bedrooms, have a good idea what you can collect and rent from those other bedrooms, or if it's a duplex, from that other side of the duplex. And that doesn't change with where the market's at now from where it was 3, 5, or 4 years ago. Those are all core principles that you should be running the numbers on.
Cool. Yeah. And, you know, one good way to calculate mortgage payment or at least get close is just go on realtor.com. They have a calculator. So go find a listing in the area that you're looking. So you make sure you get the taxes matched up properly. And then you can go through, change the home price, change the down payment, change the interest rate, and start figuring out like what ranges that you'll roughly have to pay for that price of a home. Also, your lender should be able to tell you what the mortgage payment would be when you're considering a property.
Yeah, for both of my properties, I've spent time doing the exact same thing. When I'm spitballing where I think I want my offer to be, I'm online on either Bankrate or realtor.com, plugging those numbers in. Hey, if I offer this and interest rate is this, what does my monthly payment look like?
So is there anything else in the process that you'd like to touch on?
No, I think we really hit a lot of those key areas. I think the most important thing is to select a rock star real estate agent that fits what you're looking to accomplish. And for me anyway, a rock star agent, now, of course, I represent myself, but I do work with other agents on different deals and whatnot. And what stands out to be the best for me, an individual who knows what they're talking about, who has experience and is speedy with a response. I want someone who's responsive. I will tell you that in this industry, there are so many individuals who have their license, who practice being a real estate agent, and you can't get a hold of them. And what good is that? And I think a lot of the horror stories I've heard in individuals buying or selling is literally just in communication alone. So again, trying to find that rock star real estate agent, find a good recommended lender. And then when we're going through the process of making offers, let's, again, if we're losing, let's learn from our losses and put our best step forward on what the best offer available is. And if your agent's good, he should know what type of offers are going to win. And he should be upfront and honest and say, hey, look, I'm happy to submit this offer, but I don't think it's as competitive as it could be.
Yeah, absolutely. The agent's going to have a lot of strategies on what you can do. And, you know, be okay with talking about your financial situation.
With the right agent.
With the right agent, yeah. And, you know, there's going to be trends and there's going to be cycles. You know, appraisal guarantees, waiving inspections is happening right now. And, you know, if you want to do that, that's fine. I would never... We wouldn't recommend it, but it's an option. But you know, those are two of the biggest things that's happening in this market right now. But it's not always going to last forever. You know, that wasn't the trend 2 years ago. The trends were different. And one thing that I would like to add, when it comes to making offers, I don't care what type of loan you're using and what they list that they're accepting. You can still ask. My first property was a duplex and they did not list that they were accepting FHA loans. And we just asked, and then they ended up accepting the offer. Don't worry about what they list that they're accepting. Just ask them if they would be okay with reviewing an offer with this type of financing.
You don't get what you don't ask for.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
That's great. That's great advice.
Well, Brandon, I appreciate you coming on the show. This is an awesome episode. I wish you the best of luck on your second house hack. And, you know, we're in the same city. We'll keep in touch and see how things are going. And maybe we'll get you back on later. I'd love to hear more about it, but really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much, Drew. It's been a pleasure, and I'll have to just buy some more real estate so I can come on again.
You know, if there's any contact information that you'd like to leave out there so people can reach out to you, feel free.
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn at Brandon Chittister. On Instagram, I'm Chid the Kid. Those are going to be my best areas to find me.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Drew.
That's the end of the podcast. You are amazing for listening to the whole thing. Thank you so much. Don't forget to go grab your free copy of the House Hacking Blueprint. You can download it in the podcast description link, or if you text House Hack, all one word, to 22828. Thanks again. I hope you have an amazing day.